Coming up, amid new calls to ban Muslims from coming to the U.S., the nation once again debates terrorism, security, and religious tolerance. And Judy Valente talks with philosopher Peter Singer about effective altruism, making sure your charitable donations are used in the best ways possible. Plus, Jews in San Antonio following a call to publicize the miracle of Hanukkah.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome. I'm Kim Lawton, sitting in for Bob Abernethy. Thank you for joining us. As more information came to light about the San Bernardino shooters and their extremist views, a vigorous debate continued to unfold over national security and tolerance. GOP presidential candidate Donald Trump provoked international controversy with his call for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States.
Our country cannot be the victim of horrendous attacks by people that believe only in jihad.
Many across the faith community condemn the plan as discriminatory and a violation of religious liberty. The Council on American-Islamic Relations said their faith was being unfairly singled out by a lynch mob. Thousands of U.S. faith leaders wrote an open letter urging Trump to repudiate his comments. Reverend Russell Moore, president of the Southern Baptist Convention's Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, called the plan, quote, reckless rhetoric.
The idea of banning people from the country simply because of what they believe. It's shocking to me. When I first heard this, I had to stop and say, did I really hear that correctly? And listen to it again. It's really troubling.
He said his evangelical beliefs motivate him to speak out.
When we treat people in demeaning ways, we're really assaulting the image of God. And so for me, this is first and foremost a theological issue when we treat our Muslim neighbors this way.
President Obama reemphasized that the U.S. is not at war with Islam. In his Oval Office address, he said the terrorists represent a minority of Muslims who embrace what he called a perverted interpretation of Islam.
Just as it is the responsibility of Muslims around the world to root out misguided ideas that lead to radicalization, it is the responsibility of all Americans, of every faith, to reject discrimination.
Meanwhile, fears appear to be on the rise. According to a new survey from the Public Religion Research Institute, 95% of U.S. adults say they're concerned about terrorism. 75% of them see it as a critical issue for the nation. In 2011, 53% said it was a critical issue. Nearly half of Americans, 47%, say they're worried that they or someone in their family will be a victim of terrorism. Last year, only 33% expressed that fear. Many U.S. Muslims say they continue to face rising hostility. Several mosques have received threats and hate mail. Some have been defaced. At an Islamic center in Philadelphia, someone threw a severed pig's head at the entrance. Lawmakers continue debating whether to halt the resettlement of Syrian refugees because of security concerns. More than 150 bishops, presidents of religious denominations, and heads of faith-based organizations urged members of Congress to oppose such legislation. In Indianapolis this week, despite objections from the governor, the Roman Catholic Archdiocese helped resettle a Syrian refugee family. Archbishop Joseph Tobin said he was satisfied with the security vetting process, even if the governor wasn't. Joining me now with more on all of this is Dalia Mogahed, a Muslim American scholar and director of research at the Institute for Social Policy and Understanding, and Father Thomas Rees, senior analyst at National Catholic Reporter and a commissioner on the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. Welcome to both of you. Thanks for being here. Dalia, you've spoken that you feel that the nation is at a time of danger right now because of all the rhetoric that's going around. What do you mean by that?
Well, first, I think that innocent people are in danger. They're being Muslim Americans are being attacked around the country. We have even children being bullied and beaten up at school. But more than that, I think our freedom is being attacked. I think our democracy is at risk because we're being manipulated by fear.
And what about the rhetoric that we're hearing? What implication does that have overall, Tom?
I think it's very dangerous, this kind of rhetoric. And I think it requires that Christians stand up and be in solidarity with our Muslim brothers and sisters. You know, God told us to love our neighbors, and Muslims are our neighbors just as much as Christians or anybody else is our neighbor. And we need to stand up and to speak out in defense of them, because we ought to remember that we, certainly Catholics, in our early history, in the 19th century and early 20th centuries, we were the people who were the subjects of discrimination and prejudice from the Know-Nothings, from the KKK, from lots of people. So, you know, we should not now be part of the problem when we were the victims in the past.
Dahlia, is this the same, do you see, as maybe 100 years ago or so when Mormons, Catholics, and others faced problems here? Is it the same? Is there a parallel?
There are incredible parallels. I mean, if you look 100 years ago, what was being said about Catholics? Their loyalty was being questioned. They were being accused of harboring violence and weapons in their churches. They were being accused of wanting to take over America and owing their loyalty to a foreign prince. And it's exactly what is being said about Muslims today. And so I think we need to learn. We can't keep making the same mistake over and over again.
Go ahead.
I can give you an example of that from my own life. I was visiting London in the 1980s and had an opportunity to visit the House of Commons. And while we were there on the floor of the House of Commons, the tour guide pointed out a plaque on the wall to the Minister of Ireland, quote, who was killed by the Irish Catholics. Not by the IRA, not by the terrorists, not by the provosts, killed by the Irish Catholics. And nobody blinked. This is, you know, and so I understand when Muslims hear this kind of language coming out of people, how they react, because it was the same kind of language that I heard.
And how does the nation respond to that or avoid that then moving forward, so perhaps the same situation doesn't keep happening over and over again, and especially the religious communities?
I think the religious community can just act on their faith to stand up for justice. They need to call out this bigotry and say, no, not in our name, and we're better than this.
Is there enough of that going on? Is it getting enough attention in the midst of all the noise of everything else?
You know, I think more and more Christians need to stand up, need to speak out on this, because the noise on the other side is just too much. And we need to counter that. We need to stand with our brothers and sisters in the Muslim community and say, no, this is inappropriate. This is wrong. You know, when people are talking about closing down mosques, well, if the government can close down a mosque, it can also close down a church. This is, you know, there are religious liberty issues here that apply to Muslims. And if you take them away from Muslims, then you can take them away from Christians or anybody else.
One example of that, actually, it was the Blaine Amendments. They were targeted to curtail the rights of Catholics, specifically Catholic schools. And what happened when these kinds of laws were passed is then they applied to everybody. And it was hurting the religious liberty of many, many more people. And I would really caution us against thinking that being against one group isn't going to spill over and hurt many more people.
And just very briefly, Dahlia, what is the responsibility of the Muslim community also within this?
I think the Muslim community has the responsibility of every other American, which is to stand up and call out injustice and things that they disagree with according to their faith. And that means educating people on the true tenets of Islam, and that includes their young people. I mean, I'm a mother, and I'm very concerned about religious literacy within our youth community. People need to understand what their faith is really about so that they're not exploited by extremists, whether it's on the internet or anywhere else.
We have to leave it there. Our time is up. Thank you very much. We'll actually continue this conversation online on our website at pbs.org/religionethics. In other news, a holy year is underway for the Roman Catholic Church. Pope Francis launched a Jubilee Year of Mercy by opening a special door to St. Peter's Basilica. Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI made a rare appearance at the celebration. The Vatican's holy door is opened only during Jubilee years, which the Church traditionally observes every 25 years. It's only been 15 years since the last Jubilee, but Francis designated one now because he said he believed the world needs mercy. Churches around the world, including the Shrine of the Immaculate Conception in Washington, D.C., are also opening special doors for the year-long celebration. Meanwhile, thousands watched as images of the natural world from famous photographers were projected onto the walls of St. Peter's Basilica this week. The event was titled, Let There Be Light. It was inspired by the Pope's encyclical on the environment and the Paris climate talks. But not all were pleased with a three-hour show. Some Catholics said they were unhappy with the Vatican's continued emphasis on climate change. Others complained the display was too secular. The international medical group Doctors Without Borders delivered a petition to the White House calling for an independent investigation of the deadly U.S. airstrikes on its trauma hospital in Afghanistan. According to the group, the airstrikes in October killed at least 30 medical staff and patients. The U.S. military has taken responsibility for the airstrikes, calling them a mistake. But Doctors Without Borders says many questions remain unanswered, including whether this was a war crime. The new leader of the Episcopal Church, Presiding Bishop Michael Curry, is recovering after emergency surgery. Curry was hospitalized after he had trouble speaking while visiting a church in Williamsburg, Virginia on Sunday, about a month after his installation. He released a video from his bedside. Doctors found that blood had collected between his skull and brain. They expect him to make a full recovery. This time of year is traditionally the most active season for charitable donations, but is your money being used in the best possible ways? Princeton University philosopher Peter Singer has a strategy for giving that he calls effective altruism. It's being hailed in some circles, but criticized in others. Judy Valente reports.
The list of charities seeking donations can seem endless. There are organizations that fight hunger, provide free medical care for children with cancer, or build houses for the needy. Then there are the solicitations we receive from the schools we attended, from museums, concert halls, and of course, the places where we worship. So how's a person to decide which charities are truly worthy?
You need to use not just the heart and say, I want to help this person, but you need to think about, is there really evidence to show that this is going to make a positive difference? And is this giving me the best value for whatever I'm doing, if it's my time or my money? Is this the best thing that I could be doing?
Princeton philosophy professor Peter Singer is a leading proponent of what he calls effective altruism, using your earnings to make the world better, but doing it smartly.
Simply giving to get a warm glow, giving to the person on the street who holds out their cup, or giving to a charity that shows you a brochure of a smiling child, that may or may not be doing good. You really don't know. So I wish every American would just do a little bit of research.
Borrowing a phrase from the business world, Singer calls it a case of means testing. He says most consumers would refuse to pay $1,000 for a dishwasher if they could buy one for half the price that's just as effective.
The curious thing is that with charity, people don't do that. They don't ask, do I get better value for my money by giving to this charity rather than that one? So that aspect of market thinking, if you like, that I want value for money, is something that the effective altruist movement is trying to bring into philanthropy.
It's a philosophy Singer preaches in his popular classes at Princeton, and it's one he lays out in his latest book, The Most Good You Can Do. a prolific author who's written books on the treatment of animals, personal ethics, and global poverty, Singer first began exploring effective giving in a 1972 article titled Famine, Affluence, and Morality.
People often say, how do I know my money will get to the people who need it? 10 or maybe 20 years ago, there wasn't really a very good answer to that question. But now you can go online.
Now there are websites that analyze the effectiveness of various charities. Websites like thelifeyoucansave.org, established after one of Singer's earlier books, and givewell.org, started by a couple of hedge fund managers who wanted to donate substantial amounts of their personal fortunes, but found there wasn't enough data by which to judge many charities. And how do you measure effectiveness? Singer singles out popular charities like the Make-A-Wish Foundation. He says Make-A-Wish might spend upwards of $7,000 to grant the wish of an extremely ill child. He argues it's more effective to spend that amount on bed nets to prevent the spread of malaria and save the lives of several children in Africa.
In general, if you're doing the same amount of good for seven children rather than one, that's better. And in the case of the Make-A-Wish Foundation, they're not even saving the child's life. They're giving the child one great day.
I'd like to see Professor Singer sit down with a child and tell them that their dream, their fantasy, isn't going to be realized because he doesn't think that Make-A-Wish is a worthy organization.
Michael Rosen is a Philadelphia-based fundraising consultant for several charities, including the Philadelphia Children's Alliance, which advocates for survivors of child sexual abuse.
The reality is that we do need to support life-saving charities, but we also need to support quality-of-life charities.
Rosen says it's no one else's business what charities a donor decides to support.
What we need to do is have the philanthropic community use both their hearts and their heads when making those decisions.
For Singer, this isn't only about charities. He also frowns upon tithing, giving 10% of your income to your places of worship. It's one of the most common ways people donate and totals about $100 billion a year.
Some of it may actually go to help people in extreme poverty in the world. There are some churches that do contribute to programs for that. And they may be effective programs, but some of it may go into building a grander church. And I certainly don't think that building a grander church in the United States is anywhere near as good as helping people in extreme poverty.
And that old adage, charity begins at home? Forget it, Singer says. He advocates giving mainly to charities that help people living in developing countries in extreme poverty. He says in those countries, even small donations can accomplish a great deal.
If you really read the words of Jesus as portrayed in the Gospels, it's pretty clear that he placed enormous weight on helping the poor.
Singer cites both Scripture as his basis, as well as the 4th century theologian, St. Ambrose.
Ambrose said that when you give to the poor, you are not making a gift of your possessions to the poor person. You are handing over to him what is his. The problem is that these are just words until the church puts the full weight of its moral authority behind them.
According to Singer, all religions can do better.
Churches and synagogues and mosques and so on, their institution ought to be emphasizing that obligation.
Singer also says donating to museums and other art groups, even schools, should be a low priority since those institutions can tap into other sources of income.
One of the things I find ironic about Professor Singer's position is that he is the beneficiary of such philanthropy. He holds an endowed professorship and receives his salary because a donor donated very generously.
Singer tells his students that if they want to make a real difference in the world, they probably should aim for the highest paying jobs. That will enable them to donate larger amounts of money, and that's something on which both Rosen and Singer can agree.
We have this idea that the way to happiness is to consume a lot. You have to keep running faster and faster on this consumer treadmill just to stay where you are at the same level of happiness. And when people become more generous, when they think more about others, when they give more of their time or of their money to others, that actually adds to their happiness.
Singer says whatever your income level, if you're American, you probably can afford to give even more than you're donating now. And he says you won't even miss that income, but will be happier for having given more to make the world a little better. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Judy Valente in Princeton, New Jersey.
On our calendar, Western Christians are observing Advent, the time of preparation before Christmas. Many Eastern Orthodox Christians begin their Advent fast this weekend. For Catholics, December 12th is the Feast of Our Lady of Guadalupe, which commemorates Mary's appearance to Juan Diego in Mexico in 1531 through an apparition on his cloak. And Jews have been celebrating Hanukkah, the eight-day festival of lights. On the first night of Hanukkah, in front of the White House, Chief of Staff Dennis McDonough and Jewish leaders lit a giant menorah. Hanukkah celebrates the successful revolt of the Jewish Maccabees in 165 B.C. against the pagan Syrian Greeks who had conquered Jerusalem. When the Jews retook the temple and went to light the ritual candelabra, the menorah, they only had enough pure oil for one day, but the menorah stayed lit for eight. The Jewish text, the Talmud, directs Jews to publicize the miracle of Hanukkah. We visited San Antonio, Texas, where the Jewish community holds an annual Hanukkah on the River celebration. Leaders of the Chabad Center for Jewish Life and Learning explain how they're trying to fulfill the requirement to publicize the miracle.
Hanukkah is unique in that one of the major aspects of the holiday is to publicize the miracle. And that is actually the significance of lighting the menorah, is that we light it in a public place or on a window that faces a public place to spread the miracle, to bring more consciousness to the outside world of the miracle of Hanukkah.
Welcome to the 17th annual Hanukkah on the River.
We came up with this idea to put a menorah on a riverboat and sail down the river, the San Antonio River.
The Riverwalk is the heart of San Antonio. So when we were thinking about doing something unique to San Antonio and bringing the menorah down to the Riverwalk, we said, we got to have river barges. So we started with one boat, 40 kids, and within a couple of years, we had 10 boats, 11 boats with 600 people. It's really a great opportunity to celebrate in the San Antonio spirit.
It's only once in a while that you hit upon a program that really resonates with the community. That's really the beautiful part of Hanukkah on the River, that it brings together not only the Jewish community, but the entire community, the general community as well. And it's about bringing light into the darkness that surrounds us as we move through our daily lives. The more people that attend, obviously, the more effective is the publicizing of this miracle, and yeah, bigger the better.
We do a lot of Facebook for promotion. The kids that come, they take pictures and they tag themselves, and you know, and their friends that are in the pictures, and that's how the word gets spread. It's a lot of just really natural word of mouth. When people pass by, or the kids themselves, they're not just sort of experiencing something from far in the heart of San Antonio. They're actually involved in something. They're doing, they're crafting, they're really they're baking even, they're jumping, they're doing a lot of physical and fun things, hands-on, in the center of San Antonio. And that's, I think, for the kids and for the passerbys. See, it's not just a spectacle of like Hanukkah in downtown. It's an actual hands-on fun thing in the center of San Antonio.
It is not only beneficial for the Jewish community, but we welcome the non-Jewish community as well to come and participate and hear the message of religious freedom.
We are all candles of Hashem, of God, to illuminate, to bring light and warmth, goodness and holiness to each other and to the world.
Baruch atah Adonai.
When people stand together and see the menorah being lit, we're hoping to inspire them to a greater level of commitment and dedication to their own faith and tradition.
That's our program for now. I'm Kim Lawton. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook, and I'd love to connect with you there as well. Watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. There is also much more on our website where you can listen to or watch every program. Join us at pbs.org/religionethics. As we leave you, music from the San Antonio Hanukkah on the River celebration.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Be more. PBS.